let's see, today is October 27th, 1999, and why don't you give us your name and spell the last name?
Alex Smith, S-M-I-T-H.
That's pretty simple. Did anybody know you by a nickname when you worked here? Or any
Smitty.
Other names? Smitty?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In the early days, later on they didn't.
And why don't you start out, let's talk about what you were doing before you were assigned here and how you came to Richland.
I was working in Remington Arms in Salt Lake City, making 30 and 50 caliber cartridges. And the first year in operation, we made enough cartridges to shoot 200 rounds at every Axis soldier and civilian. And we made so much, and there was three other plants besides the Salt Lake plant. And we drained all the coppers, all the country's copper stockpile. Eventually had to start drawing them from steel. Naturally, they were obsolete ammunition used in World War I. So a lot of them was never used after the first year. But so they closed the Salt Lake plant down.
Where were the other two plants?
There's one in Kansas City and one in Oklahoma, and of course back in the Remington Arms main plant.
Okay. So they were going to close the plant you were working at?
Yes.
Okay.
And they were, since Remington Arms was a subsidiary of DuPont Company, and DuPont Company was doing construction of the plant at Tanford, we were given, those who wanted to go were given opportunities of being transferred up there on a job that they had qualifications of what they needed up there. And since in a very short time, after March or April sometime, 1943, the time I got there on December the 9th, they had assembled some 60,000 workers. And from every state in the Union, at that time there was only 48 states.
That's right.
And they sent recruiters out and all over.
How did they present the job to you before you went out? How did they tell you what it was?
They told us nothing. They told us, the way he interviewed, the interviewer says, he found I'd had some machine shop experience, and he said if we were to be called upon to design a shop, that of course later on I could tell, after I saw the shop, I saw he was trying to get people who would know how to make a layout for mass production, to machine a product, is what he put it, to set up the machinery. And he referred to most of it as carpenter machinery. Around a room, how you'd have it designed and how it'd have your assembly lines and machining lines to get the best results. That was about the only thing that he anything that had any relation to the job I was to do.
And did that sound better than what was your other option if you hadn't taken him up on that?
He didn't have one.
Yeah, okay.
He was specifically looking for somebody to work in the 101 building, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when did you have the interview versus actually arriving in Pasco? What was the time lag, do you think?
Oh, it was, I was on my way in about 3 days.
Okay. You drive out?
No, they put us on a train. They paid our transportation. There was quite a, I would say there was probably about 50 people came up with me. Some of them didn't stay very long, some of them left in a hurry.
Yeah.
There was, the whole desert was torn up, and the first windstorm, but of course this was the 9th of December, and it was cold. And I remember we had these, what we called cattle cars, which was a big semi-trailer, and it had benches on either side, and the windows were all frosted up. You couldn't see out. When we came through Richland, they had started constructing the houses, But you couldn't see anything, you could kind of scrape a thing. At the time I came here, there was construction people, the engineers and people who were DuPont employees, would get a house in probably 3 or 4 months. They had top priority. But before, as the thing went along and started building, they of course built 3 reactors first. But I guess as they knew more what they were doing, they decided that they didn't need that many. So they concentrated on B and finished it first.
And you got here in December of 43?
Yeah, December the 9th.
And, yeah. How many days later was it before you showed up on the job and they were
shot? I showed up the next morning.
Okay, yeah.
And I was taken out to 101 building, and I'd already apparently had enough clearance, because there was no delay in getting in.
You mean the basic clearance? That,
yes.
Okay. Not a secrecy, you didn't have a real clearance.
No.
But you were good enough for the job. They didn't have to investigate further.
Yeah, well, I think everybody that worked in the arms plant had to have some kind of clearance.
Okay.
They had to pass a security test, and because they had gone out to ask people in the high school where they went to and up at the college, at the university. And
was the 101 building up and running when you got there?
Yes.
It was producing already?
They had a one assembly line up.
And it was milling graphite?
Yes, it was
okay.
Very crude, and of course it wasn't anything like the one we finished up with, the three we finished. I think there's two or three lines, I can't remember for sure.
Then let me ask you again, the 101 building, at least then, was only used for milling graphite?
That's all.
That was the primary purpose? Okay.
And storage, it had a big storage area for raw graphite that came in, unmachined.
And when you went in there, what did you do the first or second day? How did they orient you to?
Well, I was in the engineering department, and it was a separate, they reported directly to DuPont. Now this, as I remember this organization, DuPont was the construction engineer, and they furnished all the design and the equipment and the engineering reports and write-ups and everything, how things were to be done. But this Washington, being a strong union state, why each craft worked for their own particular craft, and they were hired out of the union hall. And there was, for example, Newberry Chandler and Lord was the electrical contractor. And I can't remember the pipe fitters, but the millwrights, of course, was another contractor. They all reported to their separate supervision. And it was a very cumbersome organization and hard to work, but the very fact that it was a war, it would never work in peace. But the very fact that the people loyalty was at stake, and everybody cooperated and bent backwards and tried to get along and work the best they could. And DuPont Company itself, they were a pretty smart outfit.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been through a lot of wars ever since the Civil War, Revolution, I guess. So
what were you doing the second day that they showed you the room?
I was
the building.
Well, I spent 2 or 3 days with engineers going over the whole plan and showing, going from the very beginning out in the raw storage shed place, and followed everything through. And what I was going to be, see, at that time they only had one shift, and I spent a week in orientation, and getting familiar, and then I was put in charge of the swing shift. And of course I had a lot of people who knew what they were doing and had worked on days. But
and if you were back then, if it wasn't top secret, if you were to come home and describe to somebody what your job was or what the purpose of the building was, how would you have described it? Yeah, no secrecy, didn't matter. How would you say, what was it that the building was doing that you were there to do?
Yes. We were there to machine graphite to a lot of different shapes and sizes to a very precise dimensions. And we at that time knew nothing about what it was for, what we were doing.
Were you familiar with graphite at all before then?
Well, yes, in a way. My background was mining geology, and I, of course, we had a lot to do with the raw materials and stuff like that.
And did you have any idea where all this was? Did you know you were on a war effort? That must have been pretty obvious.
Oh, yes. That was made very obvious to everybody.
You know. Have any clue what they were going to be using graphite for?
No.
Yeah.
Not a clue.
Did you know how much was going to be run through there, the quantities?
No idea.
Okay.
At that point, I had never seen a reactor and never seen the place it was going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they started you as the guy running the swing shift, you said?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what was that like the first few days that you did it? What was the routine?
I was learning for several weeks, and I had a lot of... Here again, everybody had the spirit of cooperation. There was no jealousy, no anything, as far as the fact that the others have been here. The only thing I could figure out is the others have been here long enough to make several mistakes, and I hadn't. And that was the reason I got the job. And of course, there was the fact that I was a shift supervisor in the arms plant. I don't know why that was, but then I do know that I had a lot of good, intelligent individuals working for me, good engineers, and a lot of them who weren't engineers but were, you know, within the limits of their background and knowledge, they were doing engineering work. And there was just nothing but good cooperation on their part to help me learn my job.
What were some of the things that you were told that were really, really important about the graphite?
Each piece of graphite has a particular place to go, and should... So they have to, each one has to be accounted for, and that has to, we have to have a method, and they had already worked out this method, and apparently it was very much a success, because you could imagine what would happen if one of those pieces of graphite that was in the center of the pile was one that was supposed to have the receiver rod through the pipe. Was in there, and you shoved that in the blank. That, in order to keep that place cool, they had no idea whether they were going to be able to do the job or not, but certainly they would never start it up if they discovered that that would happen. So everything had to be in place.
Did they give you a list of sizes and pieces?
Yes.
Okay.
They had drawings of everything.
Okay.
And I can't remember, but it was up in the between 200 and 300 different sizes and shapes of blocks.
And other than the sizes and shapes, what were the other things that they emphasized was critical about the job?
Well, like I say, though, those that required holes drilled the length of the block, which was it 3.5 or 4 feet long or something?
4 feet, I think.
Yeah, 4 feet.
Mm-hmm. And you chamfered the edges?
Yes, all had to be chamfered.
And you didn't know why you were doing that?
No.
It was just part of the specification?
Yes.
What were the small, any, were there small pieces too?
Yes, like, there were small, just 2 or 3 inches long, some blocks.
Okay.
It was different sizes. Mostly they were... They weren't much shorter than a foot, as I remember. Make everything come out even, I guess. And then there was all those blocks. There was those blocks that had instrumentation that went into the center of the control thing, and they were very special too.
Mm-hmm. And you were milling them down to the finished size, everything till they were ready to be used. Probably.
Right, they were ready to be used. We had to stack them in very precise piles, and all labeled, and they were to leave and be loaded in certain order and taken out. And one of the things that came up early on that was the fact that we had practice runs with the running the ones for 305 for the little reactor in 300 area. So we had a lot of practice in getting things done, and went out and laid that pile up. And
you were doing that as well?
Yes, it was. Yeah, they had already. If I remember right, they'd already started shipping it out for 300 area. It wasn't very long there until they had.
Before they laid the graphite in the B reactor, I know they talked about they laid up like 10 or 15 rows to make sure it all was exact, and then they'd take it out and put it into the pile. Were they doing that at the 101 building?
No. They didn't do that on purpose out there at 100 feet. This is what I was going to tell you, that there was one of the sharp engineers that was there and developed this method of measuring, so they didn't have to, they were going through before that and calipering everything, see. So in order, this wouldn't do in a mass production situation. So he set up a machine and worked with that before we got up to speed and high production. He had this developed so as he had sensors in three locations along the edge of the length of a block, three or four, depending on how long it was. And he could take this block and put it on a machine table and shove it in under those little lights on a spring. I mean, the sensors on the spring that would position that when you shoved it under there.
Really?
And that would tell if all the lights were green, it was passed.
Wow.
And if all the lights, or any one of them, was red, you had to pull it out and measure it by hand.
So instead of having to make a dozen different hand checks, you just shoved it in the box and it had spring
shoved
loaded?
It under there. It was out on a machine table and you just shoved it in. And of course then you had to pull it out and turn it one over because you had to have two dimensions to have this, plus the length.
Mm-hmm.
So there were sensors on the length, too. So we measured the length and the two sides in one push. And then you pulled it out and shoved it back in again, turned it over 90 degrees, and shoved it back in again. And if it passed all dimensions, he would send it out. Well, what we weren't sharp enough to foresee was the fact that if every one went through just a thousandth on the high side, you'd multiply that by 14. And so, apparently it was, anyway, the majority of it was on the high side. But it was all within specification.
Right.
But it...
So let me rephrase that. In specifications, say, plus or minus 3 thousandths of an inch, you expect them to average out.
Yes.
Some less, some more. Yeah. You're saying they were all heading towards the plus side.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So when we started to take them out, they load them out, and take them and put them to get laying down in the pile. They're in the... That's probably not the terminology that they use, but anyway, that's what we used. And so, by the time they worked up, see, all the shielding block with the drain of the cooling water holes were already ill to receive the aluminum. What was that? It was the lining, stainless steel.
The tubes were the fuel tubes were aluminum.
Yeah.
All the way, 2,000 of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about that aluminum. I thought surely they'd be stainless, but they were aluminum.
Had to be aluminum, otherwise the stainless would have shut down the reaction too much,
yeah,
I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's why it was aluminum. All right. And so when they shoved the aluminum tubes in, the 14th layer was the first one that had holes to receive the aluminum tubes. And they wouldn't go in.
This was in the reactor itself?
Yes, they wouldn't go past the shielding block. So they've got to figure out, because that's the first thing somebody thought of course, everybody realized that there was no control over. So
let me ask you again. The first 14 rows up, first row of holes for the process tubes, yes. None of the tubes would go in?
No.
Okay.
And so it was just that close. It was very close. It couldn't have been, if it was just 1,000ths, it'd be 14,000ths off.
Okay.
But they had to fit. They had to fit precisely through those in the
So that's when they just...
There couldn't be any airspace or anything between the graphite and the aluminum tubes.
And that's when they discovered that the error had been plus, plus, plus. That's,
yes. So we didn't have to take it all out, but we have to take enough out. And this is another thing, is keeping track of how... And they did a masterful job out there, and I don't know how they did it, because I haven't had anything to do it. Of taking that out, keeping it in order, and sending certain layers. Now, I don't remember how many they sent back, but it couldn't have been over two or three. And machined enough out to bring them down to off of those. To distribute the air as much as possible, but it was down in a zone where there was no action at all. And so, apparently it didn't. A few thousandths off didn't matter.
And if the pile was, 36 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
and those blocks were about 4 inches, so that's 3 blocks per foot, it was over 100 blocks tall. And they had to come out at the top, so that last process tube would go all the way through without binding or anything else.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Okay. And they worked out a system after that for the other reactors that, of course, they had to account for it for the rest of these, because there was two that had to go up every so often.
Right. Do you remember how you identified the blocks when you were all finished with one? It was met tolerance and you were done with it, and they stamped it. We saw them in the movie stamping it with an identifier. Do you remember what those IDs were?
No.
Letters or numbers or... Okay.
Well, that would... Okay. Was it, when you saw this, was this done? You couldn't stamp them once they were all in this. They had to be stamped before they were put in.
Oh, it looked like they were doing it at the very end. But they did put an identifying mark on them, didn't they? So they could, at the pile, when they were laying it up, they'd know which block went where.
No, they had to be, it depends on position, on the route, on how they took it out.
Okay.
It's far, well, I don't remember.
You wrapped them in paper when you were done?
No.
Just left them bare and stacked them?
We stacked them, but we covered them. We covered them all. They were always kept covered, and nobody was allowed in there. And of course, there was no smoking in there, no chewing tobacco or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. What kind of clothing were you wearing while you were inside the building working?
Well, they all... If you were... I wore my regular street clothes, but if I was out and went out into the graphite area, I put on a pair of coveralls.
It was separated from the rest of the building?
Yeah.
Okay. It's sort of a clean room for its day?
Somebody's sending a fax.
Is that what that means? Okay. So you normally just wore suit and tie, or how dressed up were you?
No, I... Just casual clothes.
You wore
a shirt. See, it was too hot to do that. Now, the only one I knew who wore a shirt I saw was the Stanton. He was the department manager, and he was a son of one of the DuPont engineers. Well, I mean, big shots.
Mm-hmm.
But he was sharp. He wasn't there because of his position. He did a good job.
Uh-huh. How long do you think you were there milling? You know, being working with the graphite. You started in December 43.
14 months.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So you did all three reactors then?
Yes. Yeah, I finished. I was one of the last construction workers to leave, because I wasn't going to leave, and they kept me here as long as they could, because then I was identifying equipment. When all this equipment was needed elsewhere, Navy had first priority on it, and the Army had second, and DuPont had third. And so we would get up, and then there was other organizations was lower than that, So you'd go out, each morning I'd go into the office, receive a teletype from either Kansas City or some other plant, either someplace mostly in Minnesota. I can't remember where they all DuPont plants. And they would tell me what they needed, describe it. And I'd go out searching the whole field for these. And I had tickets to put on there. Well, if it was somebody from the Navy or Army, they'd come along, they wanted it, they'd rip that ticket off. And by the time I got a construction crew ready to go to load it on a freight car, why, it'd be gone. And a lot of times. So I worked out, of course, I'd be in one of the ones that was there, and the Navy and the Army personnel was a little arrogant about the things, and so they were very happy to accommodate me and let me know that they ripped that off, so we'd load it on and take it. Don't know if that was legal or not, but the Navy needed it worse than we did or not. But
so 14 months from December would be like February or March of 45?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, all the reactors were up and running.
Yes.
The whole plant was running at that point. Okay. And...
Well, I don't think... Well, it'd have to be.
Well, B reactor started in September 44, about 9 months or 10 months after you started.
Uh-huh.
And...
The others weren't very far behind.
No, few months. I think by March they were all up and running.
I can't verify that one way or the other.
I'd have to look it up.
Uh-huh.
So that was the last part of your job at the 101 building,
yeah,
was decommissioning it,
uh-huh,
getting rid of the milling equipment, and everything got distributed to other people,
yeah,
other places.
Uh-huh.
And then where were you left after,
well,
that was done?
On my rounds around the plant, I became associated, not friends, but associated with the maintenance superintendent of 100F. And we were on a first-name basis and everything. I told him I was wound up here and they were looking for a place to either get rid of me and send me to the Army, or I wanted a job in operations. And obviously, they had planned on three more reactors and two more separations plants. And they had one of the two built. They had four planned, and they only ever finished and operated two of them. One is still holding the ground, as far as I know, it's still up.
It's a C plant, I think, in the east area.
Yeah,
yeah.
And, let's see, the two were built in 200 West, but one was never started up.
It was B, U.
U, yeah.
Yeah.
It was finally converted to a waste processing plant. So they did the same for operations. They hired and shipped in a lot more people than they ever needed.
Really?
So jobs weren't that hard, easy to get on operations. So going, he says, this, I can't remember who this manager, apparently he had some kind of, other superintendents thought he was getting all the breaks. So when I went, they hired me, he sent me down, he was going to make some kind of a junior engineer or something. So I was glad to get anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down there and was interviewed and sent out to 200 West. I thought I was going out there some kind of engineering job, and they said, you're going to be an area mechanic. So I was an area mechanic for about 6 months before I finally got a promotion. But that was proved invaluable to me when I got back in the engineering department, to having had that experience.
You could, dealing with the day-to-day.
I got a chance on a hands-on with all the equipment, at least in the 200 areas.
As opposed to just working with blueprints and specifications,
yes,
and things
so,
like that.
And I had served as a machinist apprentice until the Depression came on and laid everybody off, and I went back to college. So it was really a good benefit to me later on, because I was picked for certain jobs. And then, when, of course, when the engineering department and the maintenance department divided up into two different by the superintendent of, who was then the superintendent of both, was going to be superintendent of maintenance, and he came in, and I was working in town then in the federal building. It wasn't the federal building there. And he said I was going to send me out to 200 East, and so I went out. And he didn't tell me, he said, you'll know why I did this later on. Of course, 3 weeks later they announced the separations, and I was out in maintenance.
Okay, okay.
So that was another good break, because I'd had enough practical experience that, here again, it was the spirit of cooperation and being put in charge of a maintenance crew, and with not having been a craftsman myself out there, but I'd had a good background. Well, I was really, I had that experience, but if anything, it worked out fine.
Okay, hang on one sec. Take back on.
But, through conjecture, they didn't know either. I don't think that there were over 50 people on the plant, both AEC and, or was it still the Army? No, it was AEC then.
1947, I think AEC started.
Well, then it was still under the Army, wasn't it? Well, of course, a lot of the Army knew about it, but the high brass, I'm sure. But I would venture to say then there wasn't over 100 that knew it until the bomb was dropped.
And did you know anything more after you'd been there for 6 months, any feeling for what you were doing before the bomb was dropped? Did you have any inkling of what was going on at the plant?
No, we had a lot of, as I said, I'd talked enough engineers in the field, this field and that, and mostly, of course, they'd mostly be scientists, like physicists and that, but I had friends that, but they didn't know.
Did you know of radiation?
Oh, yes.
You knew about that?
Oh, we had to, okay. We had to take all the precautions.
And they called it radiation?
Yes.
Okay.
And every craftsman knew that. They had a whole, but of course, they still got them. The radiologists, what do they call them now? I can't remember.
You got your health
physicists. Health physicists.
Yeah.
No, there was a health physicist. Of course, they were very good craftsmen. Like I told you about that incident at the my pipe fitter that worked for my organization, and an operation supervisor and an operator went in to prepare this cask for another load of waste of cesium and strontium, I suppose, one or the other, I don't know what it was. But anyway, they went in and opened a valve, and the cask was supposed to be clean. It was at least drained and flushed. And he opened this drain, and some of this greenish stuff rolled out. And immediately the supervisor hollered, "Get out," and he left, and the operator knew enough to get out. But pipe fitter, he decided to be a hero and put a stop to it.
Turn it off?
Turn it off. And he, not turn it, put the plug back in. And of course that didn't fit the way it did in right in there, and they yelled at him again, and he finally left. Well, of course he had gloves and rubber gloves and everything on and whatnot. And they washed him off as soon as they could. And everything, of course, he was down and made all kinds of tests before the dawn. The thing didn't manifest itself until the scab started coming up.
Really?
Outside. And this probably was, so the radiation, the damage was deep, but it came to the surface. And so then I had to drive him to the University of Washington Medical. And then after that, we had to send him over once a month, but until it healed up. And so
was it strictly localized on his hands?
Yes.
Okay.
He must have taken internally quite a jolt too, but apparently he didn't Because actually, I guess the radiation limits was told, we were told about a, I don't know, about a fraction of what if there was any danger or damage. And,
okay. Yeah. What year do you think that was, give or take?
Yes. It was in B plant, and it was after B plant had... No, it was in T plant, because it was when they were... No, don't say it. I guess it was in B plant. Because I had the pipe fitters in both areas, but I think it was in B plant. And it would be, have to be, 1900 V plant start. It'd have to be about 1970.
Okay.
It would take 5 years.
So let's go back to 1945. You knew of radiation before the bomb was dropped. You knew that the plant had something to do with that.
Yes.
But no indication as to what was going on. So tell me what you thought when you did find out, when the bomb was dropped and the news came out. Did that make you look at Hanford in awe or in a new light?
It wasn't until later we found out that bomb was actually made in Oak Ridge. It was the uranium bomb. And the one a few days later was plutonium. Yes. So we found that out. But, of course, we were claiming credit right away for a day or two till we got it straightened out.
Right. And did that kind of make your job seem much more interesting?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, the atmosphere was here. This is a wartime project, and the war is over now. Are we all going to be out of a job? And there was all these homes here and people that was paying $37 and 50 cents rent and whatnot like that and whatnot. Should have saved a lot of money, but I don't know if they did or not. And they were making good wages. And what we were going to do, this is going to be a time of readjustment and all the industry is geared up for war and we're... And there was a... So that's why I told you about this big red permanent building going up in the center of town. DuPont looked at it as a great morale builder. I never believe it was. And people here donating their own money. This is the first time the church ever built a building on leased land.
Which one was that? Where is that?
That's the one in the center of town, overlooking on the big hill, lower looking. When we started building that church, that was the uptown district, was a swamp.
Are you talking about the one on Jadwin?
Yes.
Jadwin and Simons up in that area?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, I live right near there.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, yeah.
And see, that was just a swamp area down in there.
Oh, by the creek that runs through, maybe.
Yeah, and it was 4 feet of water there. It was just a swamp. They had to have 4 feet of landfill in there to build that up, to build that store. And I was coming through there one day, back alley on a cold winter night, and one of the owners of six of those buildings was in these, he came in here before the war and started the plumbing business in Pasco, Bailey Plumbing. And here he was in that Japanese or Chinese restaurant there fixing the plumbing. And I said, what in the world are you doing this for? He's probably a millionaire. He said, I like to keep my hand in the work. I don't want to ever lose this ability to be a plumber. And he was fixing that up. He just came in there, I guess, and I needed help. And I thought that was the oddest thing. He owned six of those buildings.
So you heard about the bomb being dropped.
Yes.
Was that 6th of August? Another one was dropped on the 9th of August. The war was over the 14th or something.
Yes.
Like that. So literally a week after you learned what you were doing there, your job might have been done.
No,
theoretically.
Yes, we were just looking around at what we were going to do. We had, we had a certain amount of debts. We had started to one very interesting thing, though. The car I had was a 39 Chevy coupe that I had before the war, and of course you couldn't buy one. And so I drove that all the way until I could buy a new car in 1949. 10 years later, I sold it for $15 more than I paid for it in 1940.
Really? Sharp businessman.
Yeah, sharp businessman. I kept it in good shape. And,
Were your kids already born before the war was over? Did you have children?
No, yeah, oh yeah, there was only two. This is another interesting little thing. I had a secretary out of work, and she was a good Catholic, and she, and this is, I was with you at that past time, and I only had, we had these two children, and the youngest one was 5 years old. And she says, how many children you got? And I said, two. Two? So she didn't say anything about it. And I said, well, my wife had such hard labor the last time. She said, if we had any more, I was going to have them. So years later, she came to a bazaar we had at our church, and she came in, and she was married then, and I hear I was towing two little kids around, see, one in each hand, and she says, she looked at them, and she looked at me, and says, did you have a hard labor?
So, all right.
Another interesting thing about it. To get back on the subject, I guess this is one of the things that happened, though.
Yeah. No, I was just curious that transition between wartime effort, you learn what the job is about, and then a week later, the war is over. How much time was there before you felt like you were back in the loop of having a real job with DuPont?
Well, DuPont didn't want to stay here themselves, and they never did push this, but once GE came in here and said, this is the industry of the future, they started talking about power reactors and peacetime use of this product is far greater. And it's unfortunate it had its advent with the introduction of a bomb, but the idea of peacetime reactors is to get as much mileage out of the fuel elements and create as little waste as possible. And of course, the weapons program generated all the waste and all the high-level stuff and whatnot. And so it's unfortunate that this is how atomic energy had its introduction. Mm-hmm. We're losing a valuable method of generating electricity. And it could be cheap, too.
What were you thinking way back, you know, in like, say, 1948, 49, 50, about where we would be 50 years later with atomic energy?
I guess I didn't have that much.
I mean, were you buying in, did it seem to you also that it must be the power of the future?
Yes, oh yes. I thought, well, we got a career right here. I always thought I'd get back in the mining business. Even after I'd gone to work for DuPont, I'd gone to Denver to train how to make ammunition. And the superintendent of the tunnel that I worked on came there to buy equipment, and he looked me up and he wanted me to go to South America. They were going to mine there in Chuquicamata, and they were going to drill a tunnel way down low and bring the ore out without hoisting the way out in up above, and be a lot cheaper. Of course, they can still get it out. I guess they drilled to put the tunnel in now. So I said, well, the minute I leave this job, I'll be in the Army, so they're not going to let me leave the country. I was married after Pearl Harbor. And, so I went and helped him buy some equipment and whatnot like that. But he didn't know a lot about mining and tunnel equipment. But he was sent over there to buy it, by Anaconda. And of course, but we were off the subject again.
That's all right. Well, let's change subjects then, too. We're working on this history of tea plant. You were in the separations area on and off. Do you have any remembrances, stories about the crane equipment in either the 221T or B plant?
Yes, I told you about the rotating hook. You think that was?
Yeah, what I didn't know is when was that and where were you at the time?
I was in Redox.
That was Redox, okay.
Uh-huh. And that was the only separations plant. It was before Purex was online. And Purex initially didn't have the capability of the dissolvers to take the E-metal. And so...
To take what?
E-metal, enriched.
Oh, right, which came along in the later years.
So for a while, during the early part of the Cold War, the only weapons plant, separation plant that was running full blast was Radox, and it was designed originally, this would have been secret before, but it was originally designed for 4 ton, and we were, in order to keep up with the production, we were going to have to do 14 ton a day. So I had a bunch of good sharp instrument people, and with the help of I had a small engineering crew, but with the help of them we designed each panel was run separated by an operator separate. So we instead of the big control rooms like they have now and like they had in Purex, it was just individual boards, just like the old bismuth phosphate plant. And so these guys were sharp enough to redesign that and locate 3 control locations. And they made a lot of other improvements. So a lot of the times with this rotating equipment, the coarse material was heating out the graphite bearings. And so I went back to Lawrence Pump and I saw one of these big sledge pumps. And there was a opening in the tank. Ordinarily we had the deep well turbines, you know, with the graphite. We tried glass bearings, which lasted longer, but we were changing out these $125,000 units and shutting down to do that about every 2 weeks or less. Sometimes they'd last a week. And we tried different bearing materials. So I went back and got Lawrence Pump to build one with all the designs, that just a regular New York sledge pump that they used for their sword, and made it small enough so it would go down through the big opening. And we installed that one pump and made an extra one. And they closed the plant down 18 months later, and we still had the original pump in there. It had some drawbacks because we had to have so much liquid in the tank before it would start. It had a siphon tube down to the bottom of the tank because they weren't long enough and it wasn't practical to redesign the build one, so we put this suction in. And of course, as long as they kept it running and everything going and kept the tank a certain level, there was no problem. But if it did happen to go below, they just had to add water and fill it up so it would prime itself.
Okay. Now, the first 6 months you spent in maintenance early on, you said they sent you out to the 200 areas?
Yes.
What kind of work were you doing in there?
Doing the area mechanic. In those days, there was no union and there was no differentiation between pipe fitter and millwright and machinist. And I worked in the machine shop. I worked for a while, and then they put me on shift, and I went out to the various buildings and worked on mechanical equipment.
Did you ever go into the canyons?
Yes. Yeah.
What kind of things would you? What was a typical job where you might be sent into one of the canyons?
Well, when they first started the tea plant, and they just gone hot, the cocoa, they had a problem with a jumper, and they couldn't get it to fit in up there, and so they put a couple of us down in the cell. We had a very short time limit, but it hadn't gotten real hot yet, and we went out and tried that jumper, so we got it to fit in place.
What would they have done if it had been hot? What could they have done?
We probably had to take the thing out. We couldn't have gone down there. They'd have probably take this out. And in those days, later on, of course, we had to decontaminate. We'd have the capability of doing that, but we didn't then. Didn't even suggest it. They had sent to the shop. We had our superintendent, they had gone back to the shop, pipe shop, and got another one built. So.
Okay, and just replaced the whole jumper.
It was a very interesting thing. It might be interesting now. There was 2 different theories here. At Hanford, we built the jumpers very rigid. They didn't bend very much or anything. They had to be right. And they had a lot of stiff framework on them. And we, one of the big improvements over the bismuth phosphate plant was that they were a flat surface to surface where the seal was. But the ones later on was oval, kind of concave, so they could be tilted a little bit, and you get away with that, see. Well, I went back to back to Savannah River. Of course, I must have known the back of mine before this, but I got back there and found out they make them as flimsy as they can. And they'd put one end down and then could bend the other one into place, take the spare hook or something like that, if it didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't depend on a good fit. They made out a schedule 10 pipe instead of 40. And they were, when they put them on there, why, they could draw themselves, they were, they did have the oval head, like we had, but they didn't have to sit straight or anything else. They got away with it.
The original design was a flat connection?
Yes.
And where was the oval used at Hanford?
At Redox.
Redox, okay. They improved the connection.
Yes.
Okay.
They improved that here, yeah.
But at T-Plant, the connections all had to fit precisely?
Yes.
When you lay it in there, it had to line up and then just fit perfectly.
Yeah.
How did you get down in the cell for that job when you were
going
down?
Well, we had ladders then. We put it on top of the tank. It got down, but something went wrong and something got out. See, when we, I don't know how they even, I wasn't there when they corrected whatever was wrong, because we were told to scram out of there.
Were you dressed in white coveralls?
Oh, yeah, coveralls. In fact, we had the plastic suit.
Were you impressed at the size of the place?
Oh, well, I saw that. I think the T building had an extra length. What was they had an extra operation area.
The laboratory, semi-works. At the head end?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it was 900 feet long, you know.
Just about, almost. It's 965, something
is
like
it?
That, yeah.
And,
865.
And I couldn't believe that, plus the fact that the walls in places were 8 foot thick. And,
yeah.
And big concrete blocks on top of it. One interesting thing that on the crane, the Redox crane developed this problem of going around down the track, skewampus. There's no way, and we didn't, it was so hot in those days, you only had 30 seconds to go up there and look, or something like that. And so, that's when I was maintenance manager of Redox, and he was wearing the rail out and everything else. It was all kinds of problems. And so, Andy Eckert and I went up, Bill Wright, and went up and we got allowance to take, I don't know how many, a year's supply of radiation or something like that. We went up there and it so happened on those old-fashioned cranes, they had one big motor in the center and they had a flange on either side that drove separate the wheels, both sides, the motor to work from both sides, and it was right in the center. And Andy noticed down there a big nut laying on there, and they got looking there, and that train was being powered from one side, and the other, all the bores were either sheared off or laying around there, those bolts. And nobody had thought of that for 2 or 3 weeks.
So it was always skewed as it went down the track?
Yeah, every once in a while they'd have to go down to the end and bang it against the end to straighten it out again. Get back and they did that so much once they broke the rail on one end.
That's funny.
And
did you ever work on the cranes at T-Plant or B-Plant?
Yes.
What type of things were you be doing with those?
Actually, most of the thing was electrical, but we had to go up and lubricate the thing.
Let me ask you this. There were two periscopes that the operator used.
Yes.
Do you remember there being television, a little closed-circuit television in the cab?
No, never.
Okay.
I never had anything like that there. First television we got put in, and we put one on before we shut down at Radox, but it never was satisfactory enough to see what you were doing.
At Redox, so at T Redox. Plant and B Plant, you don't remember TV being there?
No, there wasn't any.
Okay.
No. I would have had to know about it.
Yeah. Is it possible they installed it and never used it?
No. Well, yes, later on in T-Plant, it became the main decontamination facility.
No, I mean in the beginning.
No.
In the beginning. There wasn't a little TV screen in the cab that they never used?
No. It wouldn't be in the cab anyway. It'd have to be out on the...
No, the screen itself.
The screen, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I've heard it from plenty of people. It must be true. Do you ever talk to any of the crane operators?
All the time.
Yeah? Were they swaggering, like a fighter pilot? Were they cocky and proud of their job? Because
they were proud of their job, and they had a lot of, but they were very humble too, because they had so much at stake. The whole plant depended on them. They were the one key. It's amazing though how we would often schedule shutdowns for the top crane operator to be on shift, at least when we installed the equipment. Dismantling it was no problem. But when we started installing it,
So you'd schedule it around his schedule to make sure that the top guy was there?
There was very few that weren't good operators. But there was a few that we just didn't have any confidence in.
How many hours would they spend on a shift inside the cab working it? Would they be there the whole time? Or?
No. Well, they always came out for something to eat. Could take lunch. But they put in 4 hours, probably.
Yeah, okay. Pretty tiring job?
Oh, it is when they're putting jumpers on. But most of the time, of course, they can only do so much. They have to get instructions on the process. They had each operating department had an engineer working for the production. And he was the production engineer, and he knew the facility very well, and he had all the blueprints, and he worked with the crane operator and told him, this is the next jumper you use. They got to the point where they were pretty good at it themselves, but they had a certain order that they had to go on, because some were overlapping the other, and it would be, you had to avoid putting one of us on top, and then it would have to be removed to put the other one in.
Would they give them charts or something, or lists of how they were to go about it? Or?
I think mostly they worked by the telephone.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know that. I can't answer that.
Okay. Did you ever hang out in the cab with them?
Oh, yes.
Yeah? What kind of stuff were you doing? What was your job?
Well, they would show me. You know, you'd look down on that, and I don't see how in the world they ever operated.
Looking through the periscope?
Yeah. And it took a certain... See, the order of promotion was that they took heavy equipment operators, crane operators that operated outside cranes. But I don't know what the percentage of it was, but there was a certain percentage that just, both by mutual agreement, they weren't going to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was enough. But they did have a lot of pride in the job, but as I say, most of them were very thankful there was a being that was helping them get the chances of everything fitting in place. The jumpers had to be all fit, and a lot of times we would make new ones completely, and getting them all in the course of, if one didn't get on, why, we had to go back to the shop and get another one built on. We had to call out people at night, get a crew out there and put a jumper together sometimes.
There must have been some pretty extreme pressures to keep the thing running.
Oh, in Redox it was, I'm telling you.
Especially at Redox, yeah?
Especially Redox, because this is Purex wasn't up, you know, it was quite a while. We had all the cold runs to do and a lot of other things. I don't remember the timing, but, and then for a while, for whatever reason, none of the dissolvers had the annulus where you could put a concrete cylinder down the center for, you know, prevent criticality. And they didn't have the capability of doing this. It's E-metal, enriched metal, and I don't know, I guess it's the enriched uranium.
Which you didn't have to worry about in the old days because they weren't using any, right?
Back in that's the, right, all the old years. Dissolvers were just, they dumped the whole thing in.
And the only time they worried about criticality was probably out after it got out of the tea plant, out into the other buildings, maybe at the end of the cycles?
No.
Okay.
There was a place in 233 in Radox where we were worried about criticality, and we didn't trust valves or anything. Whenever we had to use that line, we went in and we took a flange, we had two flanges, and took a line right out. Bolted blanks.
Disconnected the pipe
and put blanks on. And then during this operation, we went in, and during that time, it was, and one time it about got away. And I had an engineer there, the name of John, I don't know whether I should say the name or not. Dugan was his last name.
Okay.
He went in to try and save the day, and he took a big overdose of radiation. He was never allowed to work in radiation after that.
Took a lifetime dose?
Mm-hmm. So he went to grape farm and out in Benton City after he went here for a long time. He got a grape farm out there and got some. So he took his full time. But he was... But he didn't come to work for me until after he was working for the engineering department then, because after that he came to work in maintenance. And then in our organization. And then
Very
he quit and went.
Okay. Tape's coming to an end. Should we take another break and see if we need to go on or not?
Okay.
See how we feel.